Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hey guys, Kevin Cruz here. Welcome to the LeadX Leadership Show, where we help you to stand out and to get ahead at work. Now, as you know, we like to switch things up here, keep it interesting, and to continue that tradition, today on the podcast, instead of me interviewing an expert guest, we're going to have the guest deep dive into their topic. You see, you'll be hearing audio from a LeadX webinar. Now, of course, there are dozens of great webinars on leadership, management, communication, productivity, and more, all archived in the LeadX app. Just visit leadx.org for more information about our webinar archive. So enough on the setup, enough background information. Here is Vanya Mathis to introduce our guest and to hand it over to them. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the webinar today with LeadX and Jen Shirkani. Jen is a nationally recognized expert on emotional intelligence. She is the author of Ego versus EQ and Choose Resilience. And today, she's going to be showing you why emotional intelligence is hard to maintain at management levels and why it's so important. She's going to go over the 8 most common ego traps and how you can avoid them. And she's going to help you discover how you can increase your leadership effectiveness by increasing your emotional intelligence. So please welcome Jen Shirkani.
Thank you. Hope everyone's doing well. Today, the topic, as she mentioned, is ego versus EQ. And I'll give you some of the tips and guidelines on how to use a little more emotional intelligence, particularly when it comes to leadership. And many of you may have had the same experience I've had, which is very often when an employee is struggling, it isn't about what they know or don't know. We have folks that are very savvy, very knowledgeable, but very oftentimes when they get into trouble, it's because of how they're managing their relationships. They're either having conflicts with coworkers, their self-awareness seems to be off, they might have a hard time hearing feedback. So this sort of behavioral science of emotional intelligence has become a real focal point for a lot of organizations who are wanting folks that can manage relationships equally well to what they know. And to define this, let me just first give you the quick definition here of emotional intelligence. So EQ is sort of the nickname, and it's made up of 3 broad components, 3 skills, if you will. The first one is your ability to recognize yourself. So it's knowing kind of who you are. It's knowing your strengths, but also knowing your weaknesses. It's recognizing what your instincts are telling you in the moment, or maybe what your behavioral patterns are in certain situations. So it's sort of recognizing the impact your behavior is having on the people around you. The second piece is reading others. So it's social awareness. It's picking up on the nonverbal signals that people send you, and really reading your audience well. And then lastly, it's your ability to respond appropriately. So instead of taking either a one-size-fits-all approach or sort of, you know, I'm going to handle you the same way I handle you, the same way I handle you, regardless of who the audience is, that is generally lower emotional intelligence. Mindfully choosing behavioral responses based on what you're doing or who you're with is a higher level of EQ. So it's recognize, read, respond. Emotional intelligence is a competency. It was actually identified and kind of coined in the 1980s. It's a very young behavioral science from that standpoint. And actually, it was called emotional quotient at the beginning, which is why EQ, some refer to EQ versus IQ, which might be street smarts versus book smarts. But it was actually identified as a form of intelligence in the 1990s. And so there's been a lot of academic work done that has documented the benefits of this behavioral science for all of us. So let me tell you a little bit about the skill set, because the competency is recognize, read, respond. But I have to have some skills that allow me to do that. There are several. Here are just a couple of them. self-awareness, as I mentioned, right? So this is that ability to know yourself, know your strengths, know your weaknesses, know even your personality type or your communication style. So if you've never taken an assessment on either of those, I recommend that you do that. I think that's really valuable information to have. It's also, of course, self-control, managing yourself, not saying or doing inappropriate things. Adaptability, so openness to change and ability to use feedback and grow with it. And then another one is optimism, which is a belief system that positive change is possible in yourself and in others. There are more, but these are pretty foundational. And if you want to work on your EQ, these are some great skills to focus on. Unlike IQ, which is set, EQ is learnable. And that's the other reason why this is such a powerful concept for us as leaders and employees, because we can do something about this. We can increase our EQ over time and see very positive results. Now, some people ask me, like, you can take an IQ test. Can you take an EQ test? And the answer is yes. You can measure emotional intelligence. There are several tools that we use and recommend. One is called the EQI 2.0. This is published by a company called Multi Health Systems, or MHS. And working with a certified provider, we would send you a link. You would answer 133 questions, and that would generate a report for you. It would give you a total EI score, and it would also give you scores on 15 skills. I shared 4 with you, but there are a total of 15 that get measured on this tool. It comes in 2 versions, the leadership version for those that have employees reporting to them, and the workplace report version, which is for individual contributors. The data is the same, and the report length is the same. It's about 22 pages. But it's great resource information and a good way to kind of baseline where your EQ is now, and then you can retest over time to see your progress. Another tool that we use that we recommend is called the ESCI, offered through Korn Ferry. And this is what they call a 360 report. So this is a multi-rater. I go online and answer the questions, but then I also send it to people in my circle. So I might send it to a boss, peers, employees that work for me, and then everyone has a chance to answer the same set of questions, and then there's comments at the end. So this is a pretty powerful report. It's not probably for the faint of heart, having done this myself. It can be a little intimidating because you are seeing how you see yourself compared to everyone else. But it's a great measure of sort of that social self-awareness. How aligned is how I see myself or the way I want to be being perceived by others around me? So this is a great tool we like to use for coaching, again, to baseline where someone is coming from and really help narrow down the areas to focus on as far as coaching or development goes. So why is EQ important? I mentioned there's been some research done, and if we look at it in particular in the context of leadership, why is this so important? One of the statistics that the Harvard Business Review published is that 2 in 5 Fortune 500 CEOs fail in the first 18 months on the job. As you can guess, being a CEO in a Fortune 500 is a pretty big job. And it can be quite challenging if the executive does not demonstrate self-awareness, self-control, and empathy. According to the Small Business Administration, 2/3 of businesses fail in the first 10 years. And a lot of those reasons, although we certainly have market conditions or other factors that contribute, a lot of times what I've seen in my almost 30 years now of doing some kind of coaching and development role is the founder has a very hard time growing out of that initial startup phase and building a bigger business. So we'll talk a little bit about why that happens in a minute. And then I found another study I thought was interesting that nearly 100% of CEOs that were surveyed said they would like an executive coach, but yet 66% don't go get one. So a lot of these executives are kind of on their own in a way, trying to figure out the best way to behave and try to manage running their companies at the same time they're managing themselves. So this has become a growing need. We also have research that shows that employees with high EQ actually make more money. A lot of people in, you know, when they hear about these, they think, oh, these are soft skills, or these are nice to have skills. But actually, these do have a very direct impact on somebody's ability to either sell more, if you're in a sales role, as you can guess, if I can recognize, read, and respond more, I'll do a better job probably closing business. If I'm in a leadership role, I usually have employees that are more engaged with lower turnover, which results typically in higher profit margin. And if I'm on a bonus plan of any kind, that number goes up. I might also be recognized more frequently and get promoted more often. So there's a lot of reasons why this actually impacts individual earning potential. And then there's another great article. This is called What Makes a Leader. And this is a synopsis of particularly emotional intelligence in business. And the quote from the article, the researcher went into companies and gave everybody assessments. And they pulled out IQ scores, technical skills assessments, and emotional intelligence scores. And when he compared the ratio of those three things, as far as how they tied back to excellent performance, emotional intelligence was twice as important as the other jobs. Now, as you get to the executive level, it becomes a key differentiator. Because as you can probably imagine, as people grow in their careers, and you get up to a senior executive level, a lot of executives even out, meaning they might have a similar education background. They might have the same years of experience in the industry. But what starts to really separate good leaders from bad leaders is their ability to work through others, their ability to motivate and engage the workforce. So that's why that EQ, you know, your technical skills, you're not doing the technical work at that point. You need to get that done through others. And those with higher emotional intelligence do it better. Now, I'd also read all this research, right? And I had also heard that middle managers actually in a typical organization have the highest emotional intelligence. So think about that. A middle manager has the highest level. And I guess if you imagine the role of that middle manager, right? They're executing initiatives from above. They're having to work through the team below. They're in sort of a squeeze zone, right? They're in a very, what I say, feedback-rich environment. So I can see how that would really help develop the ability to recognize, read, and respond. However, when we look at the top, on average, the person in the company with the lowest EQ is the executive suite, the CEO, CFO, COO. Now, that didn't make a lot of sense to me when I first heard it, because I thought, well, heck, a lot of CEOs, a lot of companies promote from within. So if they were a middle manager at some point in their career, like, where did their EQ go? How did it disappear by the time they got promoted to the top? And as I started to use my own clients to assess what might be going on here, this was sort of the beginning of this book concept, because I was trying to understand, why is it harder to maintain emotional intelligence at the highest levels of leadership? And I started to recognize certain patterns that were happening, and that's where these eight ego traps sort of came about. Now, I titled it Ego versus EQ, and I want to sort of explain that for a minute. I love this picture, by the way. So I don't really refer to ego as arrogance, or what you might think of as the self-centered leader that's all about them. What I find happens is we have managers, and I was working with a leader one time, and he was challenged, I'll say that. His team was struggling with him. And I said to him, hey, if I were to interview your team and ask them to describe your management style to me, what would they say? And he said, oh, this is really easy, Jen. You know, he had taken one of the DISC profiles, one of the communication styles. And so he's like, I am a high D. That means I'm very direct. That means I kind of say what I think, but you know, the bottom line is we're at work to do work. I'm not here to make friends. You know, I have a lot of friends outside of work. I don't need more friends at work. And I tell my team, you know, all the time, if I ever say anything that upsets you or offends you, please don't take it personally. Because I, you know, I don't mean it personal. It's business. And many of you may have worked with somebody or known somebody who has this sort of philosophy. And I was thinking about it and I thought, okay, recognize, read, respond. He has really high self-awareness, right? He knows that this is his style. He's probably heard feedback that he can upset or offend people. He's trying to head it off by warning them in advance. But basically the message he tells people is, look, this is me. This is who I am. If you don't like it, you adjust, right? And if you get upset about something I've said, you know whose fault it is? Yours, because I warned you. I told you not to be so sensitive. And to me, that was sort of the crux of ego. It was my comfort zone is more important than yours. How I like to behave, you have to do all the adapting. And so I think as a leader, it's easy to sort of let that happen. One, because people around you will do it. You know, the goal is to make your boss happy, right? So people are already going to be pretty willing to let you have the lead on comfort zone. But the leaders who recognize that that isn't always a winning strategy are the ones that really move ahead and show the highest levels of emotional intelligence. So this is sort of the defining strategy, in my opinion, behind why sometimes the smartest leaders with maybe the best track record actually fail over time, or they really don't sustain a legacy of greatness. They might have a short window of success and then start to derail, as we call it. So I'm curious if any of you have ever worked with a leader who, in spite of having very solid business skills and intellect, is not only a challenge to work with, but also perhaps their own worst enemy. Think about that. You're welcome to chat in the chat box if you would like. We're going to have questions at the end, so I'll be happy to also answer some questions as we go through this. But most people at some point have run up against this, and my condolences, because I know this can be really challenging, especially if they're your boss. Now, one thing to really keep in mind here is any strength that we overuse can start to become a weakness on us. And I know it's really hard because companies promote people on strengths, right? It's a very common thing that my knowledge is what gets me in the door. It's usually what gets me hired. And then over time, it's easy for me to rely on those strengths because that's what people value. But eventually, those strengths might start to be overused or inappropriately used to the point which they come back to hurt me. So part of that self-awareness, think about for you, what are my strengths and are there times, because a lot of times, especially under pressure or stress, that's when we snap to those strengths. So really think about for yourself, what strengths do I have that I might be over-relying on? And does my environment now require a different approach or a different response than what I've always done in the past? There are some ego triggers. Those that have what I call a type A personality, now I feel like I should say I'm Jennifer and I have a type A personality. This is something I do. Type A personalities are known to be driven, sometimes rigid in expectations, sometimes considered controlling, depending on how nice you want to use the adjectives. I get it. I've heard it all. Like intense, too detail oriented at times, micromanaging. And you can imagine how this would feed into this sense of, hey, it's all about me and my agenda and my checklist and my standards. And I'm just telling you to do things the way I do them because it works for me. So if you happen to have that type A personality, really be aware of how often that might come across as more ego than EQ. As I mentioned a minute ago, stress absolutely triggers this in us, because when we're feeling under pressure, it's easy to want to tell people, look, this is how we're doing it. We're doing it my way, and this is what's going to happen, and everybody be quiet, you know. Or I might have a stress response, which is close my door, put my head down, and don't communicate. I go into shutdown mode and problem solving mode. That's a lot more ego than EQ. So really be aware, first of all, what are your stress triggers? And then how can you manage that stress so it doesn't negatively impact your behavior? And as you could probably guess, we also have those that have image or reputation concerns. So they're very worried about something happening that's going to make them look bad. Some like to have review over all emails that go out, or really get in the weeds on external communication. Some leaders I've seen want to be involved in every single interview that happens at the company. At some point, again, if you're a growing company, you cannot sustain that. You cannot sustain being that involved on every little small issue. So you have to really kind of push yourself, again, out of your comfort zone, so it's not all about you. Okay, I mentioned these 8 ego traps. So there are 8 that I have observed. I want to just quickly explain what these are and give you a couple tips on how to avoid them. The first one is ignoring feedback you don't like, believing your technical skills trump your leadership skills, surrounding yourself with more of you, not letting go of control, being blind to your downstream impact, underestimating how much you're being watched, losing touch with the frontline experience, and relapsing back to your old ways. So I have seen versions of all of this in my work as an executive coach. And number one for a reason: ignoring feedback you don't like. Now, in some cases, you don't get feedback. And as you can guess, this is a tale as old as the emperor not wearing any clothes. The higher up I go in the company, the more difficult it's going to be for me to get good feedback. Now, I might get feedback on, hey, I don't like this new policy, or the way that we've approached this strategic decision isn't good. But it's really hard for me to get individualized feedback on, let's say, my communication effectiveness, or the way I'm managing my employees in my circle. So as a leader, and again, the higher up you go, the more important this is going to be, I have to work extra hard to get feedback. And then when I get it, I can't just sort of blow it off or say, yeah, well, that's me, or yeah, I've heard this before, or I've never heard this before. This is a one-off situation. You don't have all the details. Your opinion doesn't matter. So there's 3 reasons we don't get feedback as leaders. One is fear, right? Just the natural concern about some kind of retaliation or perception that, hey, I'm not supportive of you, or I'm not a team player. It's going to make me look bad. It won't go well. Then you won't like me. So we have to handle the fear issue to get feedback. The other one is you might make it a little painful for people. Like, I've worked with leaders who get very defensive and really challenge the feedback and really want a lot of detail. And so at some point it's like, oh, I can't go through that again. I'm just going to say everything's fine. But here's one of the key things I think happens with feedback. We sometimes give feedback to people and they may be very open to it. They may even ask for it. And then they're very gracious when we give it to them. We, you know, they do the standard, oh, thank you so much, I will take that into consideration. But if I never see a behavioral change, if you take the feedback, you listen to what I say, but you never do anything with it, at some point, I'm going to give up on you. And you can keep asking for it, but I'm going to, in my head, think, what's the point? Because nothing's ever going to change. So if you do get feedback, it's really important that you then communicate that back out. Hey, here's something I'm doing differently as a result of what I've heard. That is the true test of hearing feedback and doing something with it, even if you don't like it or don't agree with it. Now, there's a really interesting study that we came across related to feedback and leadership. And this particular study included what they call that 360 feedback report, where they actually tested 39,000 global leaders. And they looked at their own self-score against the score of their raters. And those that were out of touch with the way that they were rated by others, so the bigger the gap between their self-score and others, had a much higher likelihood of derailment. Now it ran, your choices here are between 300%, three times more likely, all the way to 600%. And sadly, the answer was D, 629%. So derailment I've seen happens when a leader is either promoted right along the way and they have a pretty regular pattern of being promoted, and then they suddenly kind of hit the wall and they can't get promoted any further. Sometimes leaders move into a role that they just are not suited for and have to either step back down and sort of get demoted, or in other cases they might have had a team of, let's say, 5 employees reporting to them, and then it goes down to 3, and then eventually it goes down to 1. And so their scope of responsibility gets shrunk. And then, of course, we have the people who just don't make it, you know, who end up departing, either voluntarily or not voluntarily, because they just can't do the job. So there's a real connection here between self-awareness, self and social awareness, and leadership success. Another reason that 360 can be quite valuable. So how to overcome this trap? As I mentioned, take a 360. You don't need to do this every year. We say every 2 to 3 years is a better time frame because you need time to process it, make change, have people see the change, internalize it. So this isn't something you would do all the time, but you could either baseline yourself with a self-only assessment, like the EQI, and then eventually move up to a 360. And if you've taken one already, then it's great to take one every couple of years just to make sure you're staying connected to perception. And then, as I mentioned, demonstrate behavioral changes made based on feedback from others. Don't just be gracious about it, but actually show what you're doing with that feedback. Okay, let's move on to trap 2, thinking technical skills trump your leadership skills. This is a common trap, and I want to define sort of technical. I don't necessarily mean technical like technology skills. This is very common with engineers, attorneys, IT professionals, doctors, anybody with a very high level of expertise. And they sometimes, again, over rely on that expertise instead of recognizing that it's time now to be a leader. And companies promote people on expertise. As I mentioned earlier, it's like, you know, the best help desk coordinator often gets promoted to the help desk manager. The best salesman gets promoted to the sales leader. And so it's not unusual that we ask people to do a very different job than what they just came out of. And leadership skills are a very different skill set. So again, it's important that we don't over rely on these technical skills and really encourage people to be more well-rounded. And when you're selecting somebody for leadership, don't just look at their technical performance, but actually consider how good of a communicator are they? Do they demonstrate empathy to others? Would they likely motivate or engage people? If you happen to over-rely yourself, if you're one of those highly skilled technical experts, really try and remember balanced problem solving. So problem solving is actually one of the EQ skills that gets measured on the EQI. And it's not just solution-based, like do you come up with good solutions? It is, can you solve problems rationally when emotions are running high? And so the most successful leaders have a good, healthy balance there between good logic, right? Doing things that data would suggest is smart, but not minimizing the piece around intuition and the impact of that decision on others. And then it's also very tempting for an organization to rely on those technical experts and go to them every time they need help. And you might have employees that come to you and say, hey, I have this situation. You know this better than I do. What do you think I should do? And too many leaders kind of take the bait there and give the answers up too quickly. And instead, what you're going to want to do is step back and try and ask a few more questions first. You know, what have you tried? What do you think we should do here? Who else have you talked to about this? What are some options you have to handle this situation? Work hard to force people around you to do more of their own critical thinking and not rely so heavily on you being the constant subject matter expert. Okay, let's look at trap three. Surrounding yourself with more of you. So this photograph actually comes from an actual Fortune 500 company. This is a sort of typical makeup that we see in large companies with a predominance of one gender at the top, with a predominance of one age group at the top, with a predominance of one nationality at the top. As you can imagine, if everybody is always coming from the same perspective, it's going to make it really hard for us to do legitimate problem solving together and have the healthy contrary opinions that we need to be successful. And this happens a lot of times in a small company because, you know, we work with people we might know. But as we grow and the companies get larger and larger, this diversity at the top becomes really, really critical. And you might not have the diversity around you because of your organizational structure, but that means you've got to go seek out the diversity. And we also run into hiring bias, right? So it's easy to sort of hire somebody who thinks like you. You imagine, oh, we're going to get along great. And not only that, we often also focus on fit, you know, cultural fit. We interview people. We have one company that we work with that's heavily technical in nature, and they've got a ratio now of about 80% of their employees that are on the introverted sort of indirect communication side. So I can imagine, you know, a more gregarious extrovert shows up to interview and she's like, "Hi, I'm Jen, nice to meet you." And everyone's thinking, "Oh my gosh, she's never going to fit in here." And so now we've got this hiring bias happening. So the goal is that you're seeking out people who think differently than you and that are willing to question or challenge you. It's really easy to go run your idea by somebody who kind of thinks like you, but you need to find that person that isn't afraid to say, "This is kind of a dumb idea," or "I don't think you've thought this through yet," or "Here's another way of approaching that." And it's easy to avoid those people because they can be quite annoying at times. But in the end, and particularly as a leader, and particularly if the decision is important, you need those contrary opinions. And then, as I mentioned, resist the temptation to hire clones. Resist that urge to hire for fit. Really ask yourself, what are we missing on this team? And I don't just mean, you know, gender or national origin. I'm talking about experience. We have a lot of clients in the Northeast of the U.S. in the New England market. And there is a hiring bias in New England to hire people, especially that came out of school in that area. They kind of look down at the state college student from the Midwest or the West Coast. And so I'm always like, look, you need a couple of those in here because it totally widens the experience level. So try not to have really tight hiring restrictions and open your mind to the possibility of adding folks with diverse education, diverse geographical experience, diverse communication style, diverse personality type. Those are great things to look for in an interview. Okay, trap four, not letting go of control. So a couple of things happen here. Sometimes this is common with a smaller company where the owner might have done a lot themselves over the years. You know, I'm in a small firm myself, so I do a lot of jobs that I traditionally probably wouldn't do. And sometimes as my company grows, it's hard for me to not do those anymore and let the people I've hired do those. So as a leader, we have to have that self-control to not get too involved in the weeds. And I, again, see leaders who get really deep down in decision-making, in researching problems, in wanting to control outcomes, wanting to weigh in with decisions on things. You know, and I think sometimes too, it's well-intended, meaning it's not always about, hey, I need to micromanage these people. But sometimes ego will tell you, oh, I'm just helping out the team, right? I'm just being a servant leader right now, getting involved to help out here. But EQ would ask, what have I done to prepare my team to work independently? What would they do if I wasn't here? And so as long as you're in the middle of stuff, it makes it really hard to hold people accountable, to assess critical decision-making skills. So it's really important that we get out of our own way here. One thing you could do, sometimes our micromanaging tendencies kick in when we don't know what's going on. So if you want to set up some kind of a status update, whether that's weekly or monthly, so you know what's going on, but you can do that without being involved. And then, as I mentioned, this also helps you break that pattern of the difficulty of holding people accountable. Because if you're involved in everything, as you can guess, and something doesn't go well, it's so easy for them to come back and say, I just did what you told me to do, right? Or I was just following directions. I did it the way you told me. And so it's like, I can't really hold them accountable to either good or bad decisions because my fingerprints are all over everything. Okay, now being blind to the downstream impact. This happens a couple of different ways. One example, and I'm personally guilty of this, is what I call the submarine boss. Okay, so the way this looks is I might delegate an assignment, I might discuss an initiative that's happening. Everyone's got their marching orders, right? So everyone's doing their thing. And then I suddenly remember, oh yeah, what's going on with that project? What's going on with that update? So in my case, it might be on the weekend before I have to travel, I'm asking myself, oh, did somebody prepare the handouts? Did those get sent over? Is my hotel booked? You know. And so here it is Sunday night. I'm texting, emailing everybody like, hey, what's going on with this? And now all of a sudden it's an emergency and everybody, and so I call it the submarine boss because I'm down there way under the water, right? Quiet. And then I suddenly emerge and knock all the boats out of the way. Again, my sudden emergency becomes everybody else's problem. The other thing I think that can happen is we level jump. And what I mean by that is I might go have somebody help me with something, but it's not in the right chain of command. And it could be because I know that person or they know me, they know how I like my reports. It's technically not their job, but I just go over and ask for a favor. Or I actually break chain of command and I go down into the organization and ask somebody to do something, but I don't notify all the people above them. So now all of a sudden that employee has a little bit of a quandary because the big boss has just asked them to do something, but their direct supervisor has also asked them to do something and they're not sure how to prioritize it and who's supposed to know what. You just put everyone in a really weird situation. So level jumping is another example of this. The other example I see is rapid change with little explanation. We had one client who had gone to a conference and he came home and he said, oh, this green initiative, you know, everyone's going paperless. I think this is such a great idea for us. So starting tomorrow, we're going paperless. Tomorrow. It's like, okay, let's think this through a little bit here. Great idea, but we need to help with the execution. And sometimes that, especially small business owner likes to have things happen really quick and very unrealistically quick at times. And in fact, do you guys think business owners have a higher rate of diagnosed ADHD? This is diagnosed. The answer actually is yes, they do. And in fact, if you're diagnosed, I call this executive ADHD. If you're diagnosed with ADHD, you are actually 300% more likely to start your own business. So if you're a small business owner and or founder and or you work for somebody and they seem a little ADHD to you, you're probably right. They probably are. So we have to really be aware of that. Okay, trap 6, underestimating how much you're being watched. You know, I think it's easy again to have special rules for you. And if you're the owner, founder, or a senior executive, there are different rules, right? But I got to tell you, everyone's watching it. And I heard a story the other day about a very large corporation, probably a Fortune 100 executive that had gone into one of the plants. They had a manufacturing plant, and he was doing kind of an all hands meeting. So he was meeting with all the frontline workers and was describing the challenges he had in arriving there, because his flight, which in which he was in business class, didn't have certain amenities like blankets and pillows. And I think he was trying to create some relatability with the group, but I think you can probably imagine this group of frontline manufacturing line workers have no idea what it's like to be able to travel on business. I don't fly business. I mean, who flies business class these days? Like, you have to be super special to fly business. And then, you know, complaining about it. It was like, it just totally flopped. And one of the employees that was there wrote to me and said, I can't believe this just happened. It's like, how do these people not understand how out of touch they look? So people are watching. If you're using different rules than everybody else, they're noticing that. You've got to remember that you are the ultimate role model for your organization, big or small. And you can use that behavior as a force for positive influence. But on the other hand, if there's things happening in your company that you don't like, the first thing you probably should do is take a look in the mirror, because it's very likely they're modeling things after you. And you, again, if your self-awareness isn't there, you may not even realize the messages that your behavior sends. And connected to that, as you can probably guess, is losing touch with the frontline experience. It's really easy to forget what it's like. And one of the shows I absolutely love on this is called The Undercover Boss. And that's where they take these executives and they disguise them and they make them go work inside their own companies and realize how difficult some of the work is that they require them to do, and what it really takes to be successful in their own companies. We had an example not too long ago with a client where things were down, you know, business was a little tight, and the company had an annual holiday bonus that they give out, like many companies do. The bonuses, they had notified the employees that the bonuses were sort of questionable for that year, and they weren't sure if they were going to receive them because of the business conditions. And so naturally, as the year went on, people got more nervous about this, and come November, one of the senior leaders went to the head of HR and said, hey, I'm curious about the holiday bonus. My team keeps asking me if we think we're going to get it this year. And she said, oh my gosh, I am so sick of hearing about this Christmas bonus, this holiday bonus. Do they think I'm not waiting for the holiday bonus? I have a brand new special order BMW sitting on the lot that I cannot go get until I get my bonus. So trust me, I'm working on it. Yeah, losing touch with the front line. So schedule time to meet with people throughout the organization, and especially if it can be agendaless. You know, it's one thing you're in town, you might have meetings scheduled, you might have a town hall type, but if you can give yourself any time to just wander around, to hang out in the lunchroom, you know, ask yourself, how long has it been since I sat in the lunchroom with everybody? A lot of executives have an office. Everyone else is in a cube. How often do you go to their cube for a meeting instead of expecting everyone to come to you? So it's little things like that that I think really help keep us connected to what's happening at the front line of our organizations. And then lastly, let's say you're all motivated, you start focusing on your emotional intelligence, you start recognizing, reading, responding, it's all about them, it's not about you, and then you have a bad day. And then you decide, you know what, today it's about me. Now, it's perfectly acceptable if that happens once in a while, because of course, we're all gonna have those times. But if your team sees you pretty regularly working to be self-aware, to read their needs, to adapt to them, every once in a while, of course, they're gonna say, sure, he or she can have a bad day. But it's when we chronically do this, and or I've seen this happen with a very successful sales leader who I watched out in the field with customers, and he was phenomenal. He was actually their best salesman, and once I saw him, I knew why. He was incredibly tolerant with his customers. He answered questions well. He wasn't overly technical, very personable, remembered details about them and their lives, and then comes to the office and is a complete tyrant. And in his mind, it was like, oh, well, that's selling and this is managing. And so for him, it was a very clear distinction why his behavior had changed. But I think the problem he had was customers came to the office. See, if they had never seen the other side of him, if they had just kind of seen him always as a jerk, but he was a universal jerk all the time, I think people can live with that. It's when the customers were in and they saw the other guy. That's what killed his credibility every single time. And he had a real challenge. He had his entire staff turn over. When I met him, they had turned over 4 times in the previous 3 years. And the last group of people all quit together on the same day while he was on vacation. So your goal is to identify and meet regularly with somebody who will hold you accountable, somebody who can give you that feedback on a regular basis about how you're being seen and if your behavior is changing with certain audiences. And then ask for feedback regularly. Don't just ask for it. Do something with it. Do a 360 so people might be more honest. Tell the team, this is what I'm working on. I am the most impressed with executives who go through that 360 and then share their report with others. Some like to kind of keep that secret, and others are very transparent about, hey, this is the feedback I got. This is what I'm working on. Please let me know if you see me not being honest to the changes I want to make here. And that's really great emotional intelligence. It really helps inspire and motivate people. So just in summary, the 3 R's: recognize your own emotions and moods by raising self-awareness, read how others feel and view the world, which is empathy, and respond with good judgment and consideration for the situation in a customized way, not in a one-size-fits-all way. And that is the skill of self-control. So now we have time for questions.
Hello, we've got a couple of questions here. Thank you. I've got one attendee asking if you can recommend any 360 degree assessments. Think back when you were talking about 2 to 3 years to do them every couple of years.
Yes, there are several available on the market depending on what you want to measure. The one we use is called the ESCI. It's offered or published, I should say, through Korn Ferry. And you can purchase those through a certified provider.
Okay, great. And then I've got another question here. How do I find an accountability partner that I can trust?
Yeah, that's a really good point. You don't want to typically, you might want to have somebody who's in the office with you, who sees you pretty regularly, be an accountability partner. So for example, I had one client who was working on her listening skills. And so she had a tendency in meetings to interrupt, to daydream, to kind of tune out. And so she had somebody who sat in a lot of meetings with her, keep an eye on that and give her feedback about it. If you're going to want feedback on more important things or things that could be more sensitive, to ask somebody internally, sometimes we can use an external coach who can also be, that way they're unbiased, they're a little more objective, and they can give you some straight feedback.
Oh, got it. That's a really good idea. I like having somebody sit in the room with you that knows
what you're working on.
Yeah. Can you provide some sample interview questions that zero in on candidates that already have a high EQ?
I can. We have my blog is called Shirkani's Musings, and I have articles that I publish every month. If you'd like to join our newsletter, it's free. You just text the word monthly to the number 22828. It'll ask for your email address. on my blog, I have several articles on interviewing for emotional intelligence, our favorite questions, the way to interpret answers. I have a webinar on it. I'll give you the link to my webinar page. I've got micro video modules on interviewing for EQ on our YouTube page. So that's a great one. We've got a lot on that. I feel very strongly that it's a very sort of proactive way to look at emotional intelligence. I can teach it. I can coach it. But my gosh, if I can hire it, I'll take that option all day long.
Right. Great. Yep. So the next question coming here is, would you give me some tips for developing EQ skills in my own teammates?
For them and their team? Is that the question?
It says, would you please give me some tips for developing these skills in our teammates? So I think your direct reports.
Giving it to others. Yeah. Okay. So generally when we're doing any kind of coaching or EQ development in others, we try to start with self-awareness. You know, most of us do have blind spots, right? It just the way it goes. And it's hard to give the feedback if the person is clueless about what they're doing. So we always try and start with giving good feedback, raising their awareness of how their behavior is impacting others around them. Then discussing, hey, how could you have done this differently based on how you're reading the room and who's there and what do they care about? And then how can you adapt that behavior? What are some of the triggers that you might notice in them? Are they worse in the morning? Are they worse in the afternoon? Are there certain people that tend to bring out the worst in them? Are they even aware of how they're being perceived by others? So it starts with feedback. Some like to do an assessment for the whole group, and then we do a group report. So we can kind of see where the team shares strengths and where they might not share strengths. And then you might even be able to partner them up with somebody who's strong in an area where they're not as strong so that they can practice building on those skills with somebody different than them.
Ah, okay, that's a good idea. I've got this next question from Christine. I'm curious about effective ways to market or advertise professional emotional intelligence skills. I guess to promote, you know, in their company, how to get people to want to improve their emotional intelligence.
Yeah. So the business case is what I try to go back to. I think most business leaders, they respond naturally to something that makes a solid business case. And I mentioned earlier, this is a lot of soft skill stuff. So a lot of leaders kind of look at this like, I can't really measure this. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't want to invest in this. And what I try to do is figure out what is the hot button for that person. You know, every executive has something they deeply care about, whether that's profit, whether that's market share, whether that's employee engagement, whether that's their own reputation. And so what I try to do, because I can make the business case that emotional intelligence hits all of those things. And when I know that they're struggling with something, I will come back and show them how developing EQ helps them get closer to that goal. If I have employees with higher EQ, they tend to be more engaged, which means they tend not to leave as often, which means retention goes up and profit goes up with it. Right? If they care about market share, I can talk about if we train our sales team on emotional intelligence, it means they're going to read the audience better. They're going to handle objections better. They're going to sell more. So there is a way to do it. It takes a little bit of work. You have to find out, first of all, what they care the most about and then connect the dots. But that is usually the strongest way to market EQ internally.
Okay, great. Our next question is, how do I balance this type of coaching style with the need to just get things done?
Yeah, so some people ask me, and one of the articles on my blog here is called EQ Does Not Equal Pushover. Some people say, well, does this mean I'm just nicey-nicey all the time, right? And I just give everybody everything they want, and if they need help extending a deadline, do I just give it to them? The answer is no. You can still hold the line. You can still ask people to be accountable. You can still deliver bad news. You can still enforce unpopular policies. It's the way you do it using EQ that makes the difference, right? We all understand there's times we're going to have to be told no. But when I have a leader who appreciates my individual concern around it, who's able to explain to me why something is happening, who, you know, we need to balance that empathy with assertiveness. When I have a leader with super high empathy and low assertiveness, then people take advantage of that person. They need to have them in healthy balance. So there's times that I'm going to have to say, I'm really sorry, I can't extend the deadline. But talk to me about what your needs are in order to meet it. And in the end, this is your deadline to meet. And I believe in you. I know you can do it. Please keep me posted on how it goes. And that's a healthy way to do this. So you need to keep boundaries. You need to not be a pushover, but the way that you approach things using EQ is the balance there between those two things.
Okay. The last question we have for the day is, any tips for helping those difficult personalities who don't seem to see the value of EQ or don't see how their personality affects the team?
Yeah. So it's back to kind of low self-awareness.
Right.
More than likely. I mean, I have worked with people, I will tell you, kind of my don't take it personal guy, you know, his attitude was a little bit like, yeah, I know I'm that way. I don't care. You know, it's like, I'm that way, they have to deal with it. And sometimes business owners can be that way. If they don't like it here, they can get a job somewhere else. More of the time, though, they're clueless about how they come across. And so I've got to tackle, first of all, the self-awareness piece. And I've got to help them. Again, when I give feedback to others, I connect it to what they care about. They care about getting promoted. They might care about being respected by coworkers. They might have reputation concerns, whatever it is. When I give them feedback about their behavior and the impact it has on others, I tie it back to, if this continues, it's going to hurt your chances of getting X. I can't just say, hey, I think it's disrespectful in meetings when you roll your eyes when your coworkers talk. You know, that might be my little pet peeve. But if frankly, they don't care about that, that's not going to change their behavior. It's not going to raise their self-awareness. What I have to do is say, when you roll your eyes at coworkers, it makes you look bad. And when it comes time to choosing people for promotion, this is going to negatively impact you. And so that's the goal there, is that you're connecting again dots between EQ and what they care about.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the webinar today, Jen. It was really great to learn all of this, all of these tips. And if anybody has any questions, please connect with Jen over LinkedIn. She's got her LinkedIn profile up there. Make sure you check out her articles and visit her website for more tips on emotional intelligence on your team and around yourself. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Jen.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Friends, if you like this episode of the LeadX Leadership Podcast, please take a minute, leave a rating on iTunes or Stitcher. Ratings are invaluable for attracting new listeners. And I like to convert those listeners into leaders because, you know, I'm on a mission to spark 100 million leaders in the next 10 years. And if you want to become the boss everyone fights to work for and nobody wants to leave, check out the LeadX platform with Coach Amanda at leadx.org. And if you have 10 or more managers who could use some binge-worthy training, send me an email at info@leadx.org, leadx.org, and we'll talk about getting you set up with a totally free pilot for those managers. See if they like it. If they don't, that's fine. We go away. Part as friends. But if they love it, you've just found yourself a new resource for them. Remember, leadership is influence. You're always leading. How are you going to lead today?